Today's program was brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi there, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this half-hour journey through culinary history. And, you know, for those of you who do any cooking, and I'm sure everyone out there does some cooking, the first thing you usually do is open the drawer and pull out your knife. Well, interestingly enough, knives for cooking, or at least the chef's knife as we now know it, didn't exist around 50 years ago, or even sooner than that, and we'll find out. Today, my guest is an authority on knives, the history of, the use of, and uses them himself. It's Peter Hertzman from Palo Alto, California. Peter's here in the studio with me. Peter is, I gotta read this, an independent author, filmmaker, blogger, website developer, cook, culinary instructor, amateur historian, an occasional butcher. I think that's a wonderful description, Peter. His book, Knife Skills Illustrated, A User's Manual, was published by Norton in 2007 and is a compendium of everything you need to know about knives, and also has made a fabulous video that I will give you a link to later. Norman, thank you. And welcome to the show. You said your interest is really in knives, right?
You just called me Norman, I think.
We were before the show. We were talking about one of your colleagues, indeed,
yes.
Norm Weinstein. Peter Hertzman. Let's start over again. Peter,
rewind.
Thank you. Well, and you're in town. I'll mention you're in town to participate in the Food Tech Conference in New York City. At the Roger Smith Hotel, and you'll be presenting on a panel about knives, the history and the usage. And you said that one of your great interests is knives, among all the other things that I just read that you do. How did you come to get so interested in the history of knives?
I fell into it, more or less. Didn't hurt myself when I fell.
Good.
I describe myself as being serially obsessive. And what I mean by that is any subject I get into, I want to know not only the direct thing of how to do something, but I also want to know why, I want to know the history, I want to know all I can learn about something. And that all affects then. And so with knives, for me it started, I was doing some knife skills classes and I had my website. And in 2005 I wrote this article on doing some basic, certain types of cuts. And it went viral for 18 hours on the internet, from a normal thing of, where I'd get 1,000, visitors a day. I was getting 30,000 an hour, all to that one article and stuff. And an agent in New York saw it and sold it to the idea to a publisher. And out of that came a book, and out of the book grew all the other stuff.
Not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Keep posting to YouTube, you guys. Well, because of your interest in knives, and you use them as well for your work, and you weren't always into food, cooking, and butchery, but...
since I'm 14.
Yeah, okay. tell me, I'm interested, of course, in your statement when you said the chef's knife did not appear, was not around 50 years ago. So I want to know about the history of knives for cooking.
So the chef's knife, which has other names, French knife, cook's knife, or French cook's knife, goes back much longer than that. It's available in the 1850s. It shows up in some of the early American cookbooks and early French cookbooks where they start putting illustrations and say what you need in the kitchen. And it begins to show up, although not by the time you get to the 1890s, it's often an afterthought. So when you look at Miss Parloa or the White House cookbook or some of the other cookbooks of that era, which gave you know, your battery to cuisine, the things you needed to run your kitchen, they would have butcher's knives, carving knives, the office knife, the office knife, which is a paring knife, sometimes they call it a vegetable knife, and they'd have chopping knives. And then once in a while, as an afterthought, they say, oh, and you may want to have a, you know, French cook's knife or something like that. When you look at the catalogs of that era, if I remember correctly, the Sears catalog does not have any chef's knives in it. The Montgomery Ward does have one or two. I have an 1898 Aubin Marché catalog from France, and that shows one style of what we'd call a cook's knife, the traditional sabatier that you've seen many times, I'm sure, by different lengths, but that's it. But they have three different varieties of chopping knives, which we at some point we need to explain to people what a chopping knife is and the difference.
We'll get there.
And then it doesn't really show up much in pictures and stuff until 1975, which is when Cook's Catalog comes out. Mm-hmm. James Beard and Bert Wolfe and, you know, those people, they wrote first a Cook's Catalog and then did International Cook's Catalog. But in that Cook's Catalog, there's four chef's knives shown. Victorinox, which is very similar to the one that you can still buy, the rosewood handles, Sabatier, and then a Hinkle's. And those are the four. It's three brands. Four, I forgot. One of them, there's two from the same brand. And that's it.
Well, when I was scouting around, when I knew you were going to be on the show, and I was doing a little independent research and scouting around for representations of what might be Cook's knives, obviously there are knives in museums. There weren't, as you said, there was a problem with illustrations and publishing. Mm-hmm. Books weren't written, and so we didn't have illustrations or drawings even in books that were widely disseminated. But, of course, there are artifacts in museums. Hard to know, except for one Roman exhibit where they were kind of grouped together with cups and other eating utensils. But so when you find other medieval knives or something, it's hard to know whether these were actually used for cooking, correct?
Or maybe were used for cooking and other things. Mm. It depends on whether or not the, you know, particular, you know, general, you know, you're talking about the average person, or you're talking about, you know, royalty or nobility that would have someone cook for them. Is the cook a full-time person? So you have things like where the, in France, in the, I believe, 16th, 17th century, the cooks were considered part of the military. So the evolution of the double-breasted white, you know, cook's jacket is an evolution from a uniform. The scabbard that you see some cooks use in those days was definitely, you know, an evolution from the scabbard. But when we use the term chef's knives or cook knives, there's one very significant difference that from all these other knives, and that is it's been designed to use on a cutting board.
Mm.
So there, when you go flat against it, you have clearance for your fingers.
So it's so the shape. So the shape is very important.
That shape, yes. All these other old knives, when you see them, you could use a tip on a board if they, in fact, had a board. A lot of times people just use tables and things like that.
Which would have been a board. But
yeah, but it's not the separate
cutting board. Not the separate cutting board, right.
Which is, becomes a difficult thing to research because there's a lot of old cutting boards used for other things other than cooking.
Right.
Or it was a knife designed to use on, like if it was for protein, it would be used against the bone. So you're using it in the air as opposed to on the table. When you look, you know, when I've looked at a lot of old recipes, you don't see much in the way of, you know, meat that's been cut into strips or things like that. You will see that's been minced, and then you get into the chopping knives for that, which are some very interesting patents.
But ordinarily, you see what, just big joints of meat, big. So yeah. They've obviously disjointed an animal with a big knife, mm-hmm. and that's about it.
Yeah. And if you look, so I think it's in, whether it's Mrs. Lincoln or I think it was in Mrs. Lincoln where she talks about, you know, you cook this big piece of meat and then the next day you make this out of part of it, this out of part of it. And so you have this sort of leftover plan almost that comes from it based on this big joint. And when you look at paintings of the period of butcher shops and stuff of the late 19th century, early 20th century, read about, you know, sort of meals that people are preparing. It's all large cuts.
Right, right. Well, tell me about, you mentioned, for people who aren't familiar with a true chef's knife or cook's knife, as it's referred to, Talk about that shape a little bit. You said it's designed so that your fingers don't fall under it and block it from the board.
Okay, so if you think of a knife, there's the spine, which is the back part that is not sharp, and you have the cutting edge, which is sharp. So you have to have a sufficient distance from between those two in order to have finger clearance. So if you think of a carving knife, or even just, you know, a dinner knife, there's no way you can really work flat on a board with that. You can use the tip.
It's usually long and thin, right?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, a slicer, and a slicer, since it's designed not to be worked, used on a board, plus because it's against cooked proteins, there it's the distance from the cutting edge to the spine has to be as short as possible because you want to reduce the amount of metal in contact with the cooked protein because that creates drag.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes it, you know, tougher to carve.
So people, if they see these knives, and you've seen them in the stores, you've seen them probably in your drawer at home in the kitchen, it's the more almost like triangular-looking mm-hmm. blade at the bottom, right? The thick one and the 10-inch. Well, there's that proverbial question, you know, 10-inch or the 6-inch, or, you know, and as you have mentioned in your video and other places, you're always asked, if you had only one knife. Okay, Peter, if you had only one knife...
It's a chef's knife. I mean,
the ten inch actual chef's knife.
I prefer a 10-inch because when you look at the actual cutting edge, and if you look the front half of that as a greater curve than the back half, and depending on which style you're getting of the Japanese versus the Western, and then some of the more modern ones, they put a lot of what's called billy, so a lot of curve in the bottom, which I don't particularly prefer. But you almost have two knives to work with if you divide that blade now in half. Hmm. So depending on what you're doing, you may use the whole blade, like if I want to cut things like, you know, a zucchini or something like that, lengthwise in half, and I want a nice straight cut, then having a long knife makes that much easier. But there's other things like, you know, thinly slicing green onions or something like that, which is only done with the heel of the knife. But then you want that nice and straight. And there's other things like you're going to strip off the leaves from the stalks and chard, or kale, there you're going to use more of the tip of the knife, and you need that round edge. It does a better job of that.
So that one knife is a multi-purpose knife mm-hmm. altogether. And it's a shame on radio we can't see that great rocking motion of the knife or the shape. But they can go to your video. We'll have to say we'll have a link to that later. And in talking about the origin of a lot of these knives and how they came to be, it's like sort of the East versus the West, as you've just referred to recently. So who were the major knife makers, and where did that shape and that knife come from?
Well, you have within the individual countries, so you have, you know, in Germany you have a knife area, and around Solingen I think is the biggest one, although nowadays it's in other places. In Thiers in France was their center of knife making. But remember, most of the knives that were being made were not being made for cooking. They were being made for agricultural use, for hunting, for military. And most of these knife manufacturers did more than just cooking knives.
Well, and they had to harness the metals to make the knives. So, where do we go back to the Iron Age? No, but we...
Well, but when you think of if you look at the year 1855 as a dividing point, so which is where Henry Bessemer comes up with the Bessemer, you know, blast furnace. And you have, because they did have steel before that, but that really made, you know, the modern production of steel possible.
Right.
And you go, like, in kitchen gadgets, you go from things being made out of tin and wood to things being made out of steel. And although the knife materials, and they could make it, a lot of, you know, inexpensive knives of the 17th century would be made out of bronze or iron or something like that, which, if you take care of it, is not necessarily a bad thing. I was at the houseware show in Chicago a week and a half ago, and there's a company that's now making, and it's a high-carbon knife, but it's not a traditional steel, and it's not polished on the outside. It's black. It's rough. It's the way it's been forged. And it was really nice, but it takes a lot of care.
I had an old one from my in-laws, or it might have been from my father-in-law's mother, and it was a full carbon seal. It was black, and you know, it had to be, you know, sharpened all the time and cleaned all the time, and it was not a pretty thing to look at. But boy, was it a great knife. I don't know where it is. I think my son probably has it now. I'm not sure. So let's talk about that, the changes in materials and what became preferable and what, in your opinion, is the best material.
You know, there's a big period that really where you see a lot of evidence of it is you know, post-Second World War, right after the war. You have companies like Elko, Cutco, get started by American Can.
Door-to-door and late-night sales.
Oh, yeah. But they were also what I would call the supermarket knives.
Right.
If you remember, you know, Williams-Sonoma and Sur-La-Table, these are rather modern.
They didn't exist, yeah. Right.
And so if you wanted a, you know, a commercial-style chef's knife, you had to go to a kitchen supply store. And except they're in the big cities, a lot of those were catalog stores where they would order it for you then. But when you went to and you opened up, like my mother's drawers, there were these knives that, you know, were what they would call stand. They were made out of a flat piece of metal, the ground on both sides, a true hollow ground knife, sharpened, made out of a stainless steel that wasn't particularly good quality. And they were thrown in the drawer and they weren't very good, but that was what was available.
Right.
The way life is. Yeah. A lot of it, you know, we have what really has opened up this market a lot has been, like I said, the combination of the, you know, the Sur-La-Tables and the Williams-Sonomas of the world, which then forced the Macy's and stuff to carry, you know, because anything like a Macy's, you know, didn't have the cellar, you know.
Yes. Not until late 70s, right?
Well, I think it was even closer to the 90s, at least where I'm in California.
Oh.
Yeah, we don't have the big Macy's in Herald Square there. And so those type of knives aren't even, you know, like I said, they're not available, but they become available partly because of, you know, people seeing them used on, you know, PBS.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we're still pre-cooking, you know, channels in those days other than that. You have the introduction of the Santoku in the 80s, but it becomes popular in the 90s. As my theory is, women like the Santoku because it's less threatening and it's lighter weight. And like I have in the video, you know, you never see anybody, you know, you never see a slasher movie made with the Santoku. But it becomes popular. It actually had followed on the Chinese cleaver became big in the 80s because some chefs were using that. But the Chinese cleaver is a phenomenal knife if you're doing Chinese cooking.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of Western-style cooking, the cut through is different enough where it's more difficult to do with that. And so the Santoku became the popular one.
So we're talking a stainless steel with a high carbon content for the best knives that
you
get.
So you take basic iron and you add carbon to it, and you get then the high carbon steel, which gives you your edge and all your strength properties that you want. Problem is it rusts or corrodes really mm-hmm. easily. So then they start adding chromium to it, which makes now your high carbon stainless steel, which is most of what people are buying. But there are different, you know, flavors of that, and some of them have better features than others. So, you know, these cheap knives that you know, you can, when you go to some of the cooking personalities, you know, web pages, they can, you know, 3 for $24.
Right. Well, hey, they get
it's
a
high
cut.
Carbon, it's high carbon stainless steel, but you know, you may be better off sharpening the license plate.
I guess they're getting a cut out of it. We're going to talk about more features of knives and specific uses when we come back with Peter Hertzman right after the break.
Today's music is by Obesity on heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program was brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 160 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, we are back on A Taste of the Past. I'm talking with Peter Hertzman about the history of knives for cooking chef's knives. But Peter, you mentioned something earlier in passing a discussion that was about how a lot of knife use was really chopping, and there's a different knife that was used for chopping. And one of your, not pet peeves, but interests, I guess, is the terminology of cutting, especially in old recipes, old cookbooks. Talk about that a little bit.
Okay, so let's describe, see how we can do it for the radio audience,
right.
a chopping knife. For a lot of people, if they've seen like a Mezzaluna, it's a version of, Mezzalunas tend to be a two-handed type of thing. These were one-handed knives, but they were designed to use in a bowl or on a board.
So you really just rock it back and forth?
No, you'd actually,
you would chop it?
You would chop it. Yeah. You think of a pounding type of action.
Yeah.
You would do that. And what it does is it does some chopping and some crushing in the way it actually works, because a lot of them are not all that sharp.
Yeah, I have an antique one that it is. It's a
like six blades.
It's
or
a
four
round
blades.
Thing, so it's only as big as a sand dollar. I guess a large sand dollar, and it just looks like a pestle mm-hmm. almost, but it's got the divided bottom,
yeah,
and you
like
just
six
bang
blades
on
that
it.
Come
yeah,
out of, yeah, that was
yeah.
My mother had that when I was growing up, and
it looks like it could do some damage rather than chop or min. It would just yeah, it would.
So in between 1885 and about 1910, 1915, there's over 50 patents for these type of knives. And there was just a huge assortment and variations that had come about. So if you go back earlier and you take someone like Eliza Acton or Amelia Simmons, those books, they tend to specify very carefully whether they want something sliced, diced, chopped, or pounded, because remember, they're still using mortar and pestles for
right.
a lot of things at that point. When you get up to Fanny Farmer and Mary Lincoln and those books, so Mary Lincoln's, what, 1880-something, and Fanny Farmer is a little bit later, a lot of times they're still not, you know, they'll say, you know, you're making, you know, stews or something like that, and they'll just say onion. They won't tell you what to do with it. You're supposed to know what to do with it.
It's okay, they don't even tell you how much onion. But
well, but those are things that you should know.
Right.
There's like biscuit recipes with no flour listed because you should know that you put flour in biscuits. One of the things really nice about those books that I really like is they tend to specify endpoints. So nowadays, if someone says, you're going to make a dough, they'll say knead for 10 minutes as opposed to knead until it has a particular smoothness or a particular texture or stickiness or whatever. The old days, they gave endpoints, which is a much better way of learning how to cook and then cooking.
Right.
Because things vary. If you read something like Perfection Salad, Laura Shapiro in that book points out how, you know, in the 1890s, turn of the 20th century, when you went to the store and you bought flour or you bought eggs or you bought meat, it was different every time. And when I was in college and we'd buy flour and you'd throw it in a big, we used these, you know, 5-gallon mayonnaise jars or something like that to store it. And you go back in a month and your flour was moving around from all the bugs and the rocks. I mean, sifters were developed for cleaning the flour, not to aerate it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the problems we get now with modern recipes is they'll still say to do things like sift when it has no value whatsoever. It's just because we used to have to sift in order to clean the flour.
So, yeah.
I realize we're getting off of chopping knives.
No, that's quite all right. It's interesting material to me. But the chopping knives, because I did post a picture of this, I think, on our website, but the chopping knives that you have, I think you have it in your book or you just reference on your website. How long were these popular for? From when to when? How long were these used approximately?
So, I don't know when they actually started. The earliest catalog I found with them is 1895, and it's not because they didn't exist before then, since I haven't found the catalogs yet. But I know they existed much later than that because, like I said, when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, my mother had one of those. Hmm. She used it. That's how she was trained, and I think you could still buy them at that point.
Well, this representation that I'm looking at of them, I don't know when it's from. But
That's either 1895 or 1897.
Well, because a very nice looking chopping knife only costs 3 cents.
Right.
So, got to go figure. That was a while back. And then from there, knives, obviously.
So let me address something that you brought up earlier, and that is my pet peeve when cookbook
recipes.
Authors and recipe writers say chopped when what they really mean is diced. And the interesting thing for me about that is, so I queried a whole bunch of authors, and I said, first of all, do you say chopped onions? And I go, and those who said yes, I said, okay, when you say chopped, do you mean for them to chop them or to dice them? And I had the two sort of ranges of answers was one, no, I really mean for them to dice. The problem I get into is my students who are totally know nothing about cooking when they start off, when it says chop, that's what they want to do then. They don't want to dice it because they don't understand that they're similar. And then I got from some people, I said, they're synonyms. They mean exactly the same thing. I said, no, they don't. Not in my interpretation, they are not the same. Mm-hmm. When you say chop, if you want someone to chop, they will chop like they're using an axe or something like that. And if you say dice, then they will cut into a series of slices in order to get some sort of a cube shape, which is what a dice is.
And usually you don't see minced use. Occasionally you see it. But my question is always, how fine a dice do they mean? Do they mean dice or do they mean mince or do they mean, as you said, chop? I mean, it is. It's a very gray area.
Well, then you get into another one of my subjects, which is how recipes don't communicate.
Mm. And I go ahead.
I have a standard hour-long presentation on that.
So. Never mind.
But when you look at recipes, they're full of words which are imprecise. So when you say, a large pot, how large is large?
Mm-hmm.
Until hot, how hot is hot? Any of that type of, you can think of all those words, and there are a whole series of all these different adjectives that could have lots of meaning, and it's relative to person's own experience.
And today, exactly, you have to understand that a lot of people don't, have, or in the early days too, but now we have such abilities to be more communicative, to be more descriptive. For somebody who doesn't know really how to cook and they're just beginning, it's a problem for them, indeed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the early books, you understand that they assumed you had a basic knowledge because everybody cooked. Not so today.
And so when you look at the history of things like the Boston Cooking School and Philadelphia Cooking School, New York Cooking School, all those, they were taking people who really didn't know how to cook a lot of times and trying to introduce them into that. And that was part of the problem of how you do that. And it turns out that I think that's done better in verbal and visual means than in written words.
Although there are some authors who do. They write very precise headnotes and endnotes, and it is helpful to the person who, is reading them who doesn't really have that knowledge, but rare.
Yeah.
Rare.
Well, then there's a paradox in recipes of if you make it as detailed as you need to do to really explain, like you were doing an experiment and you go through all the precision you need to do it, then it's too complicated for the person on the other end.
If the recipe is more than a paragraph long, I'm not going to use it, right?
Well, even if it's, it can be, how to boil an egg, but it is, when it starts off with, open your drawer and take out a pot. And unfortunately, some of my students would go, well, it's not in the drawer. How do I start this recipe?
Yeah.
So you get that paradox, and that versus the
older style of recipes, which were done as a single paragraph and just gave you an outline of what you needed
and
to know.
And you had no idea how much you could end up with a lot or a little or not know how to cook it. Okay. Well, back to knives, and I love the recipe cookbook portion of it too, but I did promise knives. One thing that surprised me, and that was the serrated knife, that it was so late coming on to the scene as far as serration and its use.
Well, the earliest patent I found for a serrated blade is actually for cutting hay in the 1860s. There's a bread knife that you could sort of describe as being serrated that was patented in 1880s, 1890s. That's the oldest, actually, culinary knife I've found for that. There are not many patents for actual serrations because there's so many different types of serrations and people have sort of, designed the machinery to do it nowadays. The significance of the serrated knife is more that when somebody picks up a serrated knife, they're more likely to actually slice with it, whereas when they pick up a straight-bladed knife, they're more likely to chop with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's just how they learned. And even when they've been watching the folks on the Food Network and all they're doing is rocking it up and down, they're still pushing it through to food, which is technically chopping. So it's sort of a subtle thing. There was common in that same either Montgomery Ward or Sears catalog that your chopping knife picture comes out of, there was cake knives, which had sort of a wavy blade to it. There was the name of the company blanking on right now, but they were interesting. They had sort of the handle was a piece of wire that was bent sort of as the outline, and that was what you held this knife with. And they made a number of things. The 1856, it's called the American Cookbook. It's an anonymous cookbook, has illustrations of a lot of different types of knives. And they have a knife in there they call a French saw. And I have, I've never seen one. I have no idea whether
it's
has
to be a serrated knife, though, right? I mean, why would they call it? Because why would they call it?
It may
saw?
Be more like a saw, also, because they have butcher knives and they have other things in there, also.
Well, I was reading some of your essays on knives and the history, and then thinking about this, of course, this new craze of everybody loving these. Very fine and also very, very expensive Japanese knives. But the Japanese really, they came to it from sword making, did they not? Yeah, they were master sword makers. So it stands to reason they would make these very fine, thin-bladed
knives. Well, when you outlawed a samurai, you have to
make it something else. But do you know anything about the when the Portuguese introduced tobacco to Japan and then knives being made to cut tobacco. You said something about the serrated knife being introduced for cutting wheat.
For hay.
Yeah. And I had read something about Japan introducing knives to cut tobacco that was introduced to them.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. I just wondered if I threw that out, wondering if you'd heard that before.
In basic knife technology in Japan, you have four knives at the turn of the 20th century that are make up the traditional knife set. They're the traditional, what we think of as a single-sided edge or single, the bevel is on one side. They're made either from a solid piece of steel or from iron where you forge weld the steel edge to it. They're thick but they actually have the actual cutting angle, the bevel itself is actually much finer than a Western-style knife. But there's a lot of metal behind that. And they're used different, and they're four specific things. So they have two what they call debas, which were for different aspects on fish. Matter of fact, most of them were for fish. You have the usuba, which is the vegetable knife, and then you have some sort of yanagi, and so all the variations of yanagi, which is your filleting knife that you use for, fish fillets, like sushi. The problem is you only have four knives in that basic set, and one of the Japanese words for four, which is pronounced as shi, is also the word for death.
Yeah.
So you get the fifth knife, the Santoku, coming in 1903-1904 era, which was the first double where they're beveling on both sides of the knife.
The beveled edge, right.
And but it's really, when you look at the older ones, it's more of it's shaped more like a Yusuba in some ways. It has the edges comes down to front. It has now a slight curve to it. In the modern Japanese knives, there's the Santoku and the Gyota, which I've been told translates literally a cow sword or is a butcher knife. That's when you go and you buy a Japanese knife nowadays, that's the shape that you're getting is that. And if you look at that, it's especially towards the heel, it's much straighter than the German style knives are.
With a smaller hand. Well, that brings me to handles, because if it's much straighter up, then the handle seems smaller. No?
It varies. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting how I happen to like the handle of the traditional Japanese knife on a Western-style blade can be very comfortable.
Mm.
If you're holding it in what I call a pinch grip, which is, I believe, the proper way to hold a knife.
And that is, for listeners who aren't aware, that you're actually pinching the end of the blade, the end nearest the handle, the blade,
right.
Not the handle, the blade. Right?
Yes. And it gives you the most control. Now, I learned it from Martin Yan, who's doing with a cleaver. So it's...
Anyone who's taken any cooking classes, the first thing they do is have a little quick course in knife skills usually. So hopefully they've learned that before they start touching these sharp knives, right? And, of course, sharpening is another thing. And that is, people try to sharpen knives themselves. And unless they really know what they're doing or, watched a video or taken
not
a course.
Mine.
It's tough. No, you don't do a sharpening in that. But I still send my knives out occasionally to be sharpened because I can't get the right angle on it consistently.
Okay, there's a couple aspects of sharpening. One is that sharpening or how sharp a knife is a matter of perception. So it's not something independent of the user. It's how you use your knife is going to depend, and you may find, the knife that you find sharp, I may find dull because mm-hmm. I'm slicing, you're chopping, or something like that. So that's part of it. Another part of it is how you take that knife from the day you get it and how you treat it. Or do you keep it the edge protected, or are you, thrown in the dishwasher, thrown against other metal objects? Are you taking a knife that's not designed to be cutting on bones and cutting bones with it? Which is the issue with a lot of the high-end Japanese knives are not designed for hard objects. They're great for vegetables, but they're not really good for, taking apart, a chicken or something like that. And you see all these reviews on Amazon where, I had this knife, I bought this chef's knife and I spent $200 on it, and after a week it's totally destroyed because I cut up a chicken. And the manufacturer would say, read the blank manual.
The warning.
Yeah, because the manual says not to do that.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Well, there are so many knives out there on the market, but as you said, if you need, I think everyone does find that in their own kitchen, that there's usually one knife that you always go to, whether it's the right knife or not, for what you're, for what you're cooking or chopping or slicing. It's what we're comfortable with.
And it's, why are you buying the knife? I mean, why does someone spend $8,000 on a set of three knives?
Right.
That comes on a very nice wood holder that's designed to sit on the counter. Well, chances are the person who buys that knife also has a number of very expensive cars in their driveway and lives in a large house. And ostentation is an important part of that. I did a paper last year at Oxford on kitchen knives as the new bling.
Hmm. Interesting.
And it turns out that there are a lot of knives that are bought just for that purpose. When you talk to the manufacturers as well as some of the sellers, and they said, and it's not just amateurs, we're talking about chefs who will come in and buy a knife not to use but to own.
Right. Well, they're beautiful. They are beautiful.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They are works of art. And a word to the wise, or to become wise, and treat them carefully, right? And do not put them in the dishwasher.
The video.
That's right. Watch the video. We will. Actually, if you go to Peter's website, it's Hertzmann, and that's with two N's, .com. And it's a fantastic and very informative video. And I enjoyed
that. And there's
that.
A lot of other stuff on the website.
A lot of other stuff on the website. You can see lots of videos. But we're talking knives today.
Yeah.
And so about the knives, it's there. And it will tell you everything you need to know about knives. Mm-hmm. Knives are interesting. They have such a recent history in the kitchen. And that surprised me, and that's why I wanted to invite you to talk about that. And actually, you approached
me
because you were going to be in town. And I urge people to go to the video and enjoy their knives and have fun cooking.
Yes.
Thanks, Peter. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.